My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me. And I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help! Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes you. See Santa Claus tonight, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're gonna die for some chickens.
Someone is.
The symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence?
You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Your Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, Joe?
Well, some jerk has been texting me constantly for the last 2 days trying to get me to talk about tonight's movie before the show, but other than that, I'm doing well.
Indeed, indeed. I wonder who that is.
Yeah,
anyway, yeah, I wonder. Also, in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. Someone from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone. This is Abe. How you doing?
Abe, good, good, good. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Perfectly good.
Excellent. All right. So, for folks who are curious, today is July 16th, 2020, that we are recording this episode. For folks who are curious, since a lot of the times episodes are released out of order, sometimes a couple of weeks later, and in the case of the Ozark episode, an entire year later. but it worked out because it was right before the season three started. Mike, you're supposed to say drink because Ozark was mentioned, but we'll let you.
No, tonight's a different drinking game.
Indeed, it is. We'll discuss. So for folks who are new to the podcast, we are a podcast that discusses and critiques genre films, so not just review. So, for example, horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, cult films, and drive-in flicks. We also try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We also have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where you can email us your comments, your opinions, your suggestions, and any email that you would like us to read on the podcast. Also, we have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. Look for that, and we will add you, and you can join in the conversation. Eric, we do have a website?
We do. You can find the website at www.darkdiscussions.com. You can find any number of things on the website. On the right-hand side of the front page, you'll find links to Friends of the Podcast, so you can go visit all them. At the top of the page, there's a link to our article section, which has articles written by myself as well as others, available for your perusal. In the audio section, you will find every single episode of Dark Discussions that's been released, as well as any of the spin-off podcasts available to download for free. There's bound to be something that interests you there, so check that out. And then front and center on the front page is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that lets you financially support your online artists, like podcasters. Producing this show is not free. We have to pay for things like web server hosting and rental fees and equipment and so on and so forth. So if you would like to help offset the cost of producing this show, That's how you can do it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions, and for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the submissions from our patrons, and once a quarter, we draw one from the hat, virtually, and pick it to do an episode on. So, if you would like to support us financially, we would greatly appreciate it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Yep, that's right. Excellent. So before we get into our episode, one notice, at least I know of, Kelly Preston, at the age of 57, has passed away from a long illness, breast cancer, that she and her family had kept quiet. So it was a complete surprise when she passed away. She will be missed. She's done a number of genre films, including Space Camp and Twins and stuff, mostly comedies and romantic comedies and things of that nature. But one of the great beauties, and leaves, unfortunately, a 10-year-old as well. So it's just a shame, absolute shame. Any other news?
There was actually another death that's even more of a shame, because this person was even younger and has just as little to do with this podcast. And that is Grant Imahara of the Mythbusters, passed away at age 49.
He was also a judge of BattleBots as well. I mean, he was actually quite prevalent, and I think he even did robotics for the RDT2 in some of the Star Wars films as well.
Yeah, he was involved in the movie industry for sure.
Yeah, Nathan apparently
had a brain aneurysm. They don't know why, but that's how he died at age 49. Yes. So that's kind of a shocker.
Well, yeah, people just get them sometimes. One of my relatives had one. Fortunately, they survived. But anyway, go on, Christy. I'm sorry.
Well, I will say this. I will say that I don't think we can underestimate the incredible stress that the unusual state of the world has caused a lot of people. And I do think that sometimes we're seeing people dying deaths that are not COVID related, that are maybe younger than they should have been, that are, because the level of stress, I mean, stress has, just physically, scientifically, it has an incredible impact on the body. And if someone is not navigating these changes well, which it's hard to navigate even if you're the most well-adjusted person in the world, this stuff is really hard. And so I think that's really honestly creating a lot of these sudden deaths. That's just my two cents, but you know, anyway.
Yep. No, and a 33-year-old Naya Rivera of Glee passed away drowning.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah, that's a really
That one was
just a tragic accident. She went swimming with her 4-year-old, I think it was, and their boat drifted away, and she got him back into the boat, but used up all her strength doing it and drowned. That's
Jesus.
Oh God,
horrible.
Yeah, that is terrible. It's absolutely rotten news, and yeah, things do happen, unfortunately. Also, Galen Gorg, one of the stars of RoboCop 2, she died at 55 years old of cancer. So there's been a lot of untimely passings this week, genre-related or not, which is very unfortunate.
As if this year couldn't suck any more than already.
Yeah, I want to mention not someone who is a celebrity, but if you've done horror conventions, somebody in the East Coast, especially in the Northeast, you might know as Elsie Ginsberg. We were next to her for ScareCon 2. Was it 2017? Our booth was next
ScareCon
to hers.
Was it ScareCon? You mean Scare as a Kid, wasn't it? Seriously?
No, it was ScareCon.
Okay.
Because she sold the pillows. She actually, in talking with her, she was local to me, just like a county over, and we had talked briefly about maybe putting on a convention here, or she had wanted to put on a convention here. Unfortunately, she just passed away from cancer. She'd been fighting it for a long time. She was already stage 4 cancer when we spoke to her, and that was 4 years ago. You know, and I bumped into her a few times since, but she also would do other conventions and film festivals. And so there's a lot of people that knew her in the Northeast horror community. You know, so we're sorry to see her go as well. Yeah, there was a lot. There was another actress, I can't think of her name, who was like a genre indie movie actress who also passed away recently. Something seems to have been hitting quite a bit lately.
Indeed. All right, so I guess we can get into our topic tonight.
Now for something more cheerful.
Jesus Christ.
Dead Indeed. Children!
Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the movie that's currently available for digital rental called The Deeper You Dig.
I need to report a missing person. Echo Allen, she's my daughter. Her coat is gone and her sled is gone. But if she went sledding, she didn't come back.
We're looking for your neighbor's daughter, 14-year-old girl. She's been missing since last night. Have you happened to see her at all?
No.
Echo Allen. Ring any bells?
No.
On the night that Echo disappeared, she reached out to me from the darkness.
That's a mother's intuition.
But then she revealed to me a sign. Tell my mother what you've done. A sign of the seven circles.
It was an accident. It could have happened to anyone. The seven circles are unforgiving. They are locked in grief. They will warp everything within them. And for you, who's turned her back on her calling, you will pay dearly.
I'll pay. Echo did not run away. Something terrible happened to her. I know, because she reached out to me from another realm. I need you to help me find out what happened to her, but you can't help me find her. Only I can do that. I want to talk to my daughter. I want to talk to my beautiful Echo. Can we do that? Please?
That's right. The Deeper You Dig is a indie drama slash horror film made out of New York State, not too far from where Mike lives. It's a family co-production. John Adams and his wife Toby co-write, co-direct, and they've done about five or six other films. Their daughter is another star of the film, and in their other films that they've done, their other daughter usually stars, but she was in college and away from the production when this was produced, because I think this was the middle of the winter, obviously, during college, and it was obviously a short filming schedule. Because it is a low-budget film. The people involved are the stars is John Adams, who's one of the co-directors, as mentioned. Toby Poser, the wife, she stars as well. And then Zelda Adams is the other star. And then there's a handful of character actors or locals that were in the production as well. The film's getting fairly decent reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, should be noted that it's getting better reviews than films like 1BR and The Lodge and things like that. But if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, as we've discussed in the past, Rotten Tomatoes just means if someone likes the film, it doesn't mean that it's a great film or a bad film. It just means that they liked the film. It got a decent review. So there's always a chance that films that are considered better by mainstream or more wider audiences may actually have a lower rating on Rotten Tomatoes. But either way, that's a good thing that they did get a good review on Rotten Tomatoes, especially for horror films. So that's pretty much all I got about the film. So I guess we can get around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. And let's start with Abe.
So I heard about this film because I just during our little chats on Messenger, that was what we decided to to see for this week. I watched it this afternoon, just kind of keep everything fresh in the mind, as I usually do. Although this was a bit of a pain in the ass because the player on Amazon Prime was really kind of janky. It kind of stopped, and so I had to move around a bit. But I managed to finish the film. I think one of the most interesting things with the film is the fact that it was a family project. You know, that had the family working together to create this. I thought that was really cool. There was some really cool visuals, and I thought all three, especially even the smaller character actors, did a pretty good job. There was a nice, some good creepy moments, and some moments I felt that they kind of got let get away from them in terms of getting self-indulgent with trying to be artsy. It wasn't a complete, you know, mood breaker or anything like that, but it sometimes it just kind of felt unnecessary. And other times, I do appreciate film and try experiment, but there are moments where I found the films that use a little lesser tricks more effective than when they try to go with complete grandeur, more fancier effects. I did think there was a cool little twist on the idea of the spirit haunting the person that wronged them. I won't say what it is because I would get into spoilers, but I thought that was pretty interesting with a nice little twist ending. Overall, I think it's a film that some people will enjoy and some people might be okay with, and some people might not like it at all. It's definitely, I think, a mixed bag, but overall, it was a decent watch. So it's going to be interesting to kind of break down, talk about, and yeah, those are my thoughts so far.
All right, very good. Mike?
Yeah, despite the fact that this was only made, you know, a county over, probably within an hour's drive of me, I didn't know about the film until, again, it came up as the thing to watch for this week. I don't know anything about the filmmakers. All I know about John Adams is the guy that was the president. I think it's I liked the movie. Watched it with Pam. I think it was Friday. She liked it a lot. I thought it does have some issues, but I liked it. I think we've talked about this in the podcast before, that it would be nice if we could just completely divorce ourselves from what we watch and what we know about the outside of the film and just watch the film for what it is. But it's hard to miss the fact that this is the way it's just watching the credits, that it's a family production, but also that it's a fairly low budget film. And so you end up kind of grading on a curve that way. I'm sure that ended up influencing my final call on it. But I ended up really appreciating what they did. And it's really a two or three person show for the vast majority of its runtime. And I kind of like what they pulled off. There are times I agree with Abe, it is a little self-indulgent. There's a little bit of a clown thing that I didn't quite get. Maybe Chrissy can explain it to me. But yeah, it is a little bit of a different a guilty conscience sort of story. So I would say give it a recommend, especially if you like a smaller ghost story character piece.
Okay, very good. All right. Yeah, for me, I actually heard about it because I actually saw it pop up on iTunes decided to skip it even though it got a decent reviews because it was a supernatural film and you have to, for me, I have to be in the mood for a supernatural film. But Eric mentioned it as a possible episode to do a couple of weeks ago. I got on board with Eric and said, all right, what's recommended? And so that's why we're doing it. I have to say that anybody who, especially a family, that comes about and puts together a film from A to Z by themselves, it's just a fantastic thing. Wonderful that they're able to do it. And I know that they're not horror directors or writers. There are other films I've read where different genres. So they just go wherever they want to go. For this film here, I know there's some, like Mike said, there's some interesting, or Abe too, the interesting aspects of the film. I know Mike, at one point when we did a film by Simon Rumley called The Living and the Dead, there was this dream, weird psychedelic sequence that he felt was kind of amateurish college type. And so this film has a lot of that, unlike Simon Rumley's film, which I felt was fine in that film. For me, the film, it was fairly boring. I did not really enjoy it that much. And if we weren't doing an episode, I probably would have turned it off after 30 minutes. And again, it's not because it's a bad film. Again, I have no hate for the film. It's just that it was kind of boring. I wasn't scared. It was dragged, I felt. It was slow, and it was kind of predictable, except for the artsy stuff that I'm sure Chrissy will explain what was going on in some of those scenes. So, yeah, I was not a fan of the film and did not like it at all. But I can appreciate the artistic work that went into it, the blood, sweat, and tears to produce it and put it together and to write it. But I felt it was a bad film, and I would not recommend it to anybody. Because I just don't know who to recommend it to. But either way, it's getting good reviews, so I'm probably in the minority based off of what we see on Rotten Tomatoes and whatnot, if that matters to you. So that's my thoughts on the film. Chrissy?
I didn't hear about this film until you mentioned it last week. I watched the trailer, and as I watched this movie and was actually surprisingly sucked in. I don't think that the trailer really does this movie justice. And I know that some of us on this podcast, you know, have an aversion to trailers. I occasionally will watch them. It just kind of depends if I'm in the mood or whatever. But in all honesty, the trailer to this, in my opinion, made this movie look boring. I was dreading watching it. But I forced myself to kind of do it last night, and I was actually pleasantly surprised by this film. There were definitely some self-indulgent moments. I agree with mostly what everyone said. However, I did graduate with my MFA, and I have learned to very much ignore the self-indulgent navel-gazing stuff. Because I just tune it out because I'm just used to it. Because in MFA programs, you get a lot of students that write this stuff that's language-wise, it's gorgeous, but it says nothing. And I think there were at least three or four scenes in here that they just could have cut, and it would not have made a difference, because art is wonderful and beauty is wonderful, but only if it's clear. If you're not reaching your audience, don't bother. Then you might as well go masturbate with your pen or your film strip or whatever. I was, like I said, I was pleasantly surprised. I found this film, to the opposite of Phil, actually very riveting. It's rich and simple. I feel that the script is very tight. It's got solid themes. It's got enough of the supernatural to make it creepy, but it wasn't a scare fest. I thought the atmosphere was the big winner in this for me. It really contributed to this film, and it helped make it what it was. I thought the acting was decent. Ivy, I felt, actually was really the best in the lot sometimes, because there were a couple of moments where her acting ability just really surprised me. It was just really good. And having spent a lot of time doing community theater, I was kind of like, oh my God, that's amazing that she pulled that particular thing off. I thought the gore was not overdone. It was enough to make the point, but not be superfluous. And I did actually enjoy the twist. I loved how we, as the audience, I knew what the mystery was, and I knew I wasn't expecting the ending on that. You know what I mean? I was expecting a different ending. I don't want to be spoilery, so I'm going to try to like talk around it. But I didn't expect the ending that I got. So most of the time in these ghost movies, they follow a very predictable path, right? You know that it's going to go A, B, or C, usually. And I watch more than enough of my share of ghost movies to kind of understand there's basically three holes you can put it in. This one really surprised me.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Giggity, giggity.
Yeah, yeah, giggity, giggity. You're so disgusting, Abe. But anyway. I also was very surprised that there were a few moments that were very tension-filled. And I do agree with Phil in some ways, because the business with, like, the radio just went on too long. There were some times where it just seemed like there wasn't enough tension for me. But then there were a couple of scenes toward the end where the tension just really worked. And it's kind of funny. I thought there were special effects that were well done. There's one particular special effect that I was very blown away by, particularly since it's an indie film and it's got a kind of a small budget. And also, I appreciated, as a tarot card reader and as an empath, that the tarot cards were actually handled very well in this film, which I'm going to talk about. Overall, I liked it a lot. This may end up on one of my top 20, but it definitely falls in that category of not for everybody. I think it has definitely things of merit, but I also think it has some things that kind of fall a little short. So anyway, I'll be quiet now.
All right, sounds good. And purposely, Eric, last, because I put myself in further suspense after bothering you for 2 days.
Well, this is going to be a disappointment, because I'm right in the middle here, Phil. I found this movie really hit and miss for me. I generally liked it. I did not particularly care for that ending that Chrissy was referring to that was unexpected. And also the kind of pretentious stuff really didn't hit me the right way either. I didn't care for the soundtrack/design. I don't know what you want to call it, but there was a lot of electronic noise that I did not care for. It really kind of hurt my brain, and that might have been intentional, but I still didn't like it. If that's what they were going for, it was effective. However, there was a whole lot I did like about this movie. Probably the number one thing I loved about this movie was the cinematography. Apparently, John and Zelda did the cinematography together, and I hope they continue to do so, because there were some amazing shots in this movie, particularly involving blackness. There's a shot towards the beginning of the movie where the mom is in a room that's black, and there's a shot where she's wearing this necklace that's highlighted very much on purpose, and there's a couple of shots where it just looks like her head and the necklace are floating in blackness. It's really cool. And then there was another shot that caught me later on, which was just, it was a house. There were no lights on, and there was just a window and a doorway and a silhouette of somebody in black. And it really just, the contrast struck me quite hard. So I really enjoyed the cinematography. I thought the acting was good. And for the most part, I liked the story, with the exception of the ending and the BS pretentious parts. So overall, I would give this a cautious recommend. However, it would depend on who it is. Not everybody is going to love this movie, and I don't think Phil is necessarily nuts for feeling how he does about the movie. It's not going to work for everybody, but for the most part, it worked for me. So I give it a thumbs up.
All right, very good. And I like the winter shots too. A lot of good outdoor shots.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty good. All right, so Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. All right. In the aftermath of a roadside accident, the line between the living and dead collapses for a mother, a daughter, and a stranger.
All right, that's good. I like that wiki. Doesn't tell you too much.
Right.
It removes the supernatural part, which is odd because most of the spots I read the little their versions of the wikis all mention supernatural, but this doesn't say anything.
Well, it does.
You think
the line between the living and the dead collapses? So that implies supernatural for me.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah. Okay. I stand corrected. All right, so I guess we can get into things generally that aren't spoilery that is, I guess, before we get into that section, and we'll start with Chrissy. Chrissy, Mike mentioned Poesque, and then I mentioned Crisis Change, and then the three beats. But again, some of that stuff you may not be able to talk generally without going to the spoilers. But that stuff is in here, right?
It is definitely in here. I mean, I can't talk about the Poesque elements of this without totally ruining the movie. So we would really have to throw up a spoiler alert before I can talk about it. It was very specific. I do feel that because there were also some allusions in here to specific Poe works. You know, that I also can't really talk about until we go into, you know, spoilers territory. But definitely, and I think for the most part, it was done very well. Because although there's a clear supernatural solution to this, if you will, you still don't really know. Like, I think they pulled this off really well. That's one of the things I have to give this movie kudos for, is that it did very well with that, in particular. I also think that, you know, you were saying about the atmosphere and the winter scenes and stuff like that. I did also want to talk about where this was filmed. I think that's pretty spoiler free, so I can probably talk about that. But Mike also lives closer to this area in New York State than I do. This was filmed in Sullivan County, New York. And that area of New York is in the lower Catskills. And it's a very interesting area because it's an area that used to be considered the Borscht Belt. For those of you who don't know what the Borscht Belt is, back in, let's say, the 20s, 30s, let's say the 20s or the 60s. Well, basically, the Jewish population would flee New York City in the summer. And those of us on this podcast and those of us who are listening to this recording right now, who are Gen Xers or younger, might, or a little younger, might remember the movie Dirty Dancing. The resort where that took place was a classic, what they call Borscht Belt resorts. And what would happen is, in the days before air conditioning, the Jewish population, and others too, but mostly the resorts were Jewish, would flee the city. And they would flee New York City for months. Yes.
Have you seen the show on Amazon, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Oh my God, yes. I was.
So is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yep. And she goes up and she plays that whole Borscht Belt circuit. Now, what's fascinating about that is that if you go to Sullivan County now, there are wrecks, abandoned hotels everywhere. Grossinger's is there that's abandoned. That was a big one. She even mentions that in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The Pines is still there. In fact, The Pines is where the second half of my novel, Bad Apple, is actually set.
I was about to say, I think there was an abandoned hotel in some book I read by someone.
Yes, exactly. That is all around.
Was that The Shining?
No. No, Mike. This is in New York. This is right in your backyard, Mike. This is like
the No, I'm joking about Eric about the
Yeah. But that's true too. But if you go and you visit that area and you actually explore some of these old hotels, which I have and Nathan has, you do have to have gas masks. In fact, there are a few films that I won't list here because there's a list that's quite long that were filmed at some of these abandoned properties after they were abandoned, but in the 80s before they totally fell into disrepair. That area is just kind of creepy. It definitely has a desolate, isolated feel to it. You definitely drive by a lot of abandoned homes. So, you know, when Kurt is talking about, oh, it's this abandoned home, I'm going to flip it. And Ivy says, oh, yeah, we used to party here. That's very common up there. It is not uncommon for you to drive through any kind of road on Sullivan County and see, like, tons of abandoned, like, old summer camps, homes, whatever. And I think that really attributed to the atmosphere of this movie. I really think they used where they were shooting to their advantage. I did not have a chance to see where they actually shot this film, but the second the dudes showed up at his door and said, we're Sullivan County Police, I went, yeah, that's Sullivan County. I mean, the bridges, the way the streams looked, the foliage, the woods, that was definitely Sullivan County. I could have picked, and I was kind of suspecting. I was like, I think this might have been filmed in the Lower Catskills, but I wasn't sure. So for me, that was a huge winner. But anyway.
And I think, you know, this is that we'd like to judge the film on its merits. Christy, you know the area. Eric, you know the upstate New York area, if not specifically the Catskill area. Obviously, I live in here and have been living here most of my life. I think that's part of it, right, is that it just feels familiar, right? And we've actually done, mostly inadvertently, we've done a number of movies on this podcast that are set in upstate New York, probably a disproportionate number. Not intentional, but, you know, the one with the fire ghost, what was that one called, Phil, Eric?
That was called We Are Still Here. Yeah,
that's We Are Still Here. So that's another one.
A Quiet Place.
A Quiet Place. The one we just did, The Room, was another one.
That's right. Yeah.
And Villains, was that another one?
Which one?
Villains.
I don't know if that was. I thought that was Michigan, but I can't remember.
Anyway, so it's kind of hard to take that feeling of, oh, look, I know this place, at least in general, because, you know, lots of places, it's woods, but it's your woods. You know, it's the woods that you're familiar with. And they all have their own unique geography and flora. And it's just hard to miss.
Well, it's no different. I mean, that's the same. It looks pretty much the same as anywhere in New England, to be honest, but yeah, or Quebec for that matter. Yeah, I mean,
that upstate New York or any part of New York, maybe it's just because, like Eric, I kind of grew up summering there and stuff. It is a very different look. Like the Adirondacks looks completely different from the area where this film was shot. Connecticut looks different from Rhode Island. I mean, there are very subtle differences, but it might just be because I spent a lot of time there. The smells are different. The feel is different. The look is different. It's just, you know, it's hard sometimes because in recent years, films have done a great job with doing things like we filmed this in Canada, and it does look like freaking Connecticut, you know, so I didn't check, but then, you know, I have a feeling this film actually was filmed where they said it was, because the bridge, without being spoilery, there's a scene with a bridge where she gets out of her car. I actually did see a photo of that bridge because I Googled Sullivan County and that bridge popped up and I went, oh, holy shit, that's the bridge. And I know exactly where that bridge is. And I compared it with a screenshot of the film, and I'm like, that's the bridge. So I think they actually did film it there. So I think
they actually cite the towns. I think Liberty might have been one, but they do cite the specific towns in which they shot if you watch the credits. So
yeah, I know there was some in Fallsburg, too, I think they said. I didn't watch the credits because I got sucked into something else. But, yeah, I'll have to check that out, Mike. Thanks.
All right, very good. Yes, yes. All right, so no more talking about trees and stuff. Let's talk about the movies and all that other good stuff. So, what else do we want to talk about?
Snow.
Okay, yes, yes. It takes place in the winter. And so that obviously was intentional. Though I think it's more atmospheric. I can't think of the symbolism or anything like that, except that everything's dead.
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's part of the cycle of the seasons, you know, where spring everything comes alive, and then by winter things have died and weathered or become frozen over. I mean, one thing that is most clear through the setting is that a lot of the animals, aside from a few shots of deer prior to the accident that set things in motion, every animal we see from that point on is dead. Which is representative of not just the setting, because the trees have all sort of leaves. We see animal carcasses in part of the hauntings and stuff like that. Some of the visions require dead and rotten animals. So, you know, the season is not just a pretty setting, but a haunting setting, but it's meant to kind of tie into this sort of cold and desolate feeling that is cast over the cast.
Right, and also, I think the setup. Though I mean, they could have had anything to be the setup, but I think the setup of the accident was interesting because obviously that's the winter is required to have that setup and that type of accident occur. Also, that was interesting about that accident too is when the guy's driving through the woods in the middle of the night, the deer are coming from the right to the left, but we never see the actual accident, but the accident occurred from left to right because it was on a slope where the left was going up and the right of the road was going down. So I thought that was interesting. I don't know if that means anything, but
It kind of does actually, Phil, and I'm sort of glad you picked up on that, because there's a whole thing in this movie going on with deer and stags. You know, I mean, the girl's a hunter, right? And in the opening of the movie, she talks about, which was kind of interesting, because what I thought initially was she mentions 20 and she mentions the number 7. So I actually thought she was talking about a 20-point buck, you know, and like something about 7. I wasn't sure what that was. Maybe 7th year in a row. We don't find
I'll get 7 and 20, right. Yeah, that confused me too.
Yeah, it did. But that's revealed later. And I think, Mike, I actually went back and I have the subtitles on when I watch a movie on my computer, because I am going partially deaf in my right ear. So on my computer, it's really hard for me to hear things. So when I watch movies on my machine, especially for Dark Discussions, I always turn the subtitles on. And Mike, they deliberately did not make that clear. And because I actually went back and watched it again to check and make sure I didn't miss something. And they deliberately kind of misled you there or didn't want to give you all the information, because it would have been telegraphing kind of what happens later. So I do give them kudos for that. But the stag and the deer, you know, these people, you know, the mother is clearly psychic, even though she's denying it. The daughter probably has the gift too. They both have a connection to nature. The stag or the deer or whatever you want to call it, it's a symbol of leadership in witchcraft or in Wiccanism or in people who practice nature magic. And so, I'm trying to do this without being spoilery. Going toward the left, Phil, is always going toward the subconscious, okay? Going toward the right is coming out into the real world. So the fact that those deer were running toward the left sort of signified that they were going into the subconscious. And after we have a spoiler, I will explain what all this means, because I did make extensive notes on it. But basically, that moment where you see the three deer is a foreshadowing. It is a very strong foreshadowing. But like I said, I don't want to do it till we throw up the spoiler alert. So anyway, so you're right about that, Phil, is basically what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's good. And I guess we could probably get into the spoiler part now so we can get into more detail instead of kind of skirting around that stuff. So we'll throw up the spoiler alert and we'll talk about anything and everything. There's a lot of stuff that I'm sure Chrissy has, including what we just talked about, that will be symbolic, and the only way to really talk about it is to talk about what we actually see on the screen. So spoiler alert is up, so be warned. All right, so let's get into it. So yeah, the accident is and it happens right at the beginning of the film, pretty much within 15 minutes, a sledding accident. Immediately earlier in the film, this girl was saying that she wants to go sledding in the evening, but the mother says that she can't because she has an appointment as a tarot reader with some old lady, and she wants to make sure she gets the money before the old lady decides to move on. So she said, you know, we'll sled tomorrow. Girl's probably early
14, 15,
high schooler. Yeah, high schooler. But when that statement happened, I immediately knew that she was going to be, the girl's going to die, because she says, yeah, but you know, I have to make sure that, you know, I'm there. The mother says, because if I don't, you're going to go into the road or something. And there's a lot of places around here that are like that, where I live, where people can sled, but it leads right into the road, and that's not a good thing. So I kind of knew that was probably going to happen. What I did not know was that the guy was going to try to cover up the murder, or I should say the manslaughter. Well, it is manslaughter for sure, because he was driving most likely drunk or under the influence.
There was a scene where they're bar, so he was actually showing, make sure they showed him stumbling prior to getting to his vehicle.
Well, and it also had the Chekhov's gun, which is, he says, "Can I have another beer and another shot?" So you knew he's at least had four drinks before he's left the building too, and so because of that, he's going to try to cover up the murder. And then of course there's another twist, which is she's not dead yet. She was in a concussion, and so he suffocates her and kills her. So the whole thing was bizarre.
That was a bad decision.
That was a really bad decision.
Well, Chrissy, I don't even really know what to say. It's like, it was just bizarre. It's like,
okay, I felt really bad for him. That was the thing when it first happened. I mean, he didn't seem like he was an asshole right off the bat. He just seemed like he was super lonely. And at first, when he was living in this abandoned house in the first 5 minutes there, when we see him sweeping things, I didn't realize he was like fixing an abandoned house. I thought that maybe he was just camping out there because he was a loner or something. So I didn't really understand that he was actually like going to flip it, like he says later. So I thought he was more maybe wounded by the world. You know, he lives on his own in the middle of nowhere. He's a recluse. I think he definitely, obviously, the impression is he has problems. He thinks nothing of driving drunk. But they don't at first, in those first 5 minutes or whenever we first meet him, present him as a complete dick. And when he sees what he's done, I think we have all seen our share of movies, right, where the drunk guy hits somebody and they freak out, right? I think we've all seen that. Mm-hmm. What was interesting about this movie was that he almost burst into genuine tears. I don't know if that was in the script or if that was the actor's performance, but it was less a, oh, fuck, what did I do? I'm going to get in trouble type of crying in that moment. They made us feel kind of bad for him. I could see that he felt sorrow, that in those few minutes he genuinely felt sorry, or at least that's what the actor was kind of projecting. So I did feel bad for him. And so at that moment, I was kind of excited to see, oh, okay, what is his epiphany going to be? Is it going to be he should no longer drink? He also had a wedding ring on. So I was like, what the fuck happened there? Is this going to be a peacemaking thing with a dead wife or whatever? I don't know. Yeah, he had a wedding ring on the whole time. The entire time you see it on the steering wheel. And then it's very prominently featured when he's digging the grave. So by the time he was digging the grave, I was like, oh, fuck, did he kill his wife? Is that why he's drinking? Like, I was like, my mind was going everywhere. I'm like, what's going on? Something is going on with that guy. But then when he did that to her and he killed her when she was still alive, I was shocked. I sat there going, oh, shit, what is this? Like, it was so shocking because he appeared so genuine. And then getting into the Poesque thing, the first image that we see after she's dead and her hand goes limp is he pulls his hand away and he's got the blood on his hands just like Lady Macbeth. Big, loud symbol there. You know, she could never wash the blood off her hands.
That one I actually got on my own.
Yeah, and I – but. You know, but Eric, you shouldn't.
Oh, blood on his hands.
Exactly. But that's what's cool about it. Like, these are the images.
Are you talking about the black cat?
No, I'm talking about Macbeth and Shakespeare. Lady Macbeth.
Oh, Shakespeare.
She can never wash the blood off her hands. She spends the whole play washing blood off her hands.
Yeah,
for
she goes time. She goes insane from
cut
it.
Out dense spots.
She goes insane from it. And so that was the first clue. That, like Mike said, this is going to be very Poesque because this guy is going to be driven insane by the blood in his hands. Because even when he kills her, it feels impulsive. It doesn't feel like he premeditated this.
Yeah, it was pure panic.
I have
a question for you. I got a question for you, Chrissy. I'm confused. Why would Shakespeare be considered Poesque? Because when we were talking Poesque on the internet with Mike – I thought he was meaning the black cat when I hear or the casca, the amontillado or whatever it's called. So you know what I'm saying? Where there's guilt.
I was thinking more Telltale Heart.
Yeah, Telltale Heart.
Oh, yeah, that's another one. Yeah.
This movie has a lot of parallels to the Telltale Heart, including the fact that the whole house is about you see him prying up boards. That's extremely Telltale Heart. But to answer your question, Phil, it's Shakespeare came first, but Shakespeare was the original, or at least maybe not the original. There probably were writers before him, but maybe we don't know them as well in our wide consciousness, right? He was the first dude to really write about the consequences of guilt. I'm sure there were others, so don't criticize me if there are scholars out there who know more, because I'm sure there are. But he's the one that really drove it home. Because Lady Macbeth was the first and the best one who had the blood on her hands. And Poe got it from that because Poe was very well studied. And all he did was really take that shit and kind of update it for his times and write it in a different way. Same thing we do now, right? You know, we have these modern, when I say something's Poesque, I'm really just referring to Poe was really the first one to kind of come up with the idea that it wasn't just guilt that could trigger something, right? He was really – what he kind of did was take all of the things that came before him, literature-wise, and sort of strain it all down through a funnel and put it in four very simplified ways that you could classify. He was really the first person to just kind of strain that all down because the canon was too massive before that. You know, because we didn't have, I mean, even when Poe was alive, the world was getting more connected through media and through newspapers. Even more so now. I mean, my God, we have the internet. Things go instantly. But back in the 1800s and 1900s, you know, even in Journal of the Plague Year, they talk about how, oh, my God, news travels so fast now. you know, because it took 4 weeks to get somewhere and that was fast. You know, so it's all within the context of what we think of as modern for the time. But certainly when I say Poe-esque, I'm talking about Poe was the first one to strain it down. But Shakespeare did a lot with it. I mean, you know, Lady Macbeth was really the first guilt-driven character I can think of. And there's probably more before her, but I didn't read that far because, you know, I'm educated, but I'm not certainly that educated. I don't know everything in the world. I'm sure I'm missing something.
Well, and there's not a whole lot, I would imagine. I'm sure we have stories before Shakespeare, but not a whole lot that have been as well preserved.
Yeah.
Well, and Shakespeare also was a writer for the commoners, right? Before that, you had a lot of writers that were only writing for the aristocracy, right? Because they were educated. They could read and write and, you know, whatever. But the, quote, common people, you know, the workers, a lot of them were illiterate. And I don't mean illiterate in a derogatory way. I just mean they literally could not read, like, there or write. Their communication was all oral, which is why you had stories who were passed down. And Shakespeare at that time was putting things into common language. Like, he was telling stories of the aristocracy and their terrible crimes, much the way, like, we look at celebrities today, in a simple common language that the commoners who could not read or write could relate to.
One thing that was very interesting of the house shock of that moment was, initially in the beginning of the film, I thought we were going for a more grayer area of the storyline. When we, after we established the kind of individual the mother was, and her, during her, consider her practices with her the tarot cards and stuff like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I thought we were going for a much more ambiguous thing, because when I was watching it, because they were very light on the, in terms of the impact of the accident. That honestly wasn't sure. I had to really go back and watch a few times to see where the moment happened really hit her. At first, I thought he came across her, and because he was drinking, I thought he was panicked because he thought he'd be blamed after finding the body, and he was deciding whether or not to grab her. Because at first that was the case. So I thought, you know, this was just going to be a story of bad decisions of a more, you know, an accident, rather than pure murder, but then it became more of a black and white afterwards.
Well, yeah, and I did appreciate that about this film, Abe, because when it started, especially when she started talking about, you know, I have this meeting with Mrs. Minsky and they go into all that, which I still want to talk about, just because I am an empath. I do see clients. I do read tarot cards. I have many friends who are psychics that I consult, and they consult me, so I'm kind of in this circle. So this movie sort of brought a different level to me. I was expecting the same thing you were expecting. I was expecting a very vague, like, you know, what the hell, and blah, blah. And I really liked the fact that for the most part, except for what we talked about, those moments where it just gets like, what is this doing here? I mean, they could have cut a few things and really it just would have been better. The pretentious stuff, you know, like, well, there were a couple of dreams with people screaming. I was like, what the hell is this? Like, we don't need this.
I was going to ask you guys about that too, because she had that box, right?
Right.
That theoretically opened up the, what the seven circle, the seven, what the fucks. So all that, like, screaming pretentious stuff happened because of that box, and, like, that box was, as far as I could tell, inconsequential to anything happening in anywhere else, right?
Yeah, I kind of had a problem with that, too, Eric. The only reason I was personally okay with the box being there was because I thought it might have been maybe one of the filmmakers' sort of references to the Dybbuk box, which I know we've talked about on this show before with other movies, which is like basically a box full of demons. I'm not going to divert us off the track of the movie and go into that here. You can look it up. It's called the Dybbuk box. But it's like a box where you know, it's just got amazing power. And so I thought that might have been a reference to that, but I really thought that whole thing was not necessary.
Yeah, I agree. What was happening before that box entered the picture.
Totally.
It had nothing to do with anything. It was just an excuse to get the pretentious shit.
Correct. I felt that she should have just gone to her old student, right, because she was his mentor, and said, I have, you know, and he could have communicated the message, which was important. You still see, you just no longer have faith. That's very important. And as a psychic and a tarot reader and a an empath, that message is very important, because you do have those moments where you're like, oh my God, I can't deal with this anymore, and you turn it off, or you fail somebody, or you call it wrong, and believe me, you lose your shit, you know, because that is what you live by, and you lose your shit. It's like losing your religion, like the REM song. You just don't know what to do. However, I did not think that whole shit with the box was necessary. I thought it was an excuse to be pretentious, and we didn't need it. She could have just gone to him and said, you used to be my student. Please help me. I read your book. I'm so proud of you. I couldn't go as far as you. Can you please tell me the secret? And then they could have done a kiss to cigarette and just cut it right there.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have even mattered. Like, we didn't need all that other shit. Right.
I honestly think it would have been much more impactful if she found that connection on her own rather than in this fucky box.
Well, I would agree too, because this guy only shows up in one scene,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of reminded me of the dude in The Shining.
He did.
You know, like Scat Crothers, like they were totally trying to copy that.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Yeah, what is going on here? Like with the big focus on his face and the smile, I was like, oh my God, they ripped that right out of Stanley Kubrick. Okay. And then like he had the light blue suit with the big rose. It was too much. It really wasn't necessary.
The one thing I did like about one of the pretentious dream things was in the one that was in the white room. There was that guy that was all that was black.
Oh yeah,
I'm not just talking about like an African American. Like no facial features at all and was completely black. That was creepy.
Now I think that was
in my opinion that was the only one that was necessary, Eric.
Well, yeah,
point there. We didn't need all that other shit after it.
And
yeah, that was.
I agree, because there was the reason I agree with that is not only was it a nice little weird moment, but the creature, the thing that he takes on the platter, it feeds her is the snake, which I think is because one of the things that they're seeking, she's looking for is truth, and the snake is in within Christianity is represented deception, lies, and stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah.
And now she has to try to consume this thing as a step forward in order to see truth. That was what I got from it.
Yeah, me too. And I also appreciated the fact, Eric, that and Abe, that besides the fact that scene was so cool and it made the point, again, you didn't need the box. You know, there could have been another way to present that, but still lead us into that because it wasn't gross. Like, it was only slightly gross, but they could have made that really foul and disgusting. And, you know, you got the point. And it was brief. And that I applaud them for. Because they could have made that so disgusting. And they did.
I think I really, really liked about some of the other moments where it came into the haunting with those visuals was where I mentioned earlier where Les was more like when Kurt is being, he's finding like dead animals around the place. And if you look carefully, they're all like roadkill kinds. You know, he finds the dead coyote. He finds the dead deer in the basement, only half the deer, and stuff like that. And he himself starts to fall apart from the inside out, where he starts puking up the maggots and stuff like that. They're gross moments, but they're symbolic in terms of the very fact that all other things are connected to the accident.
Well, it was yes, and that's really cool. And the other really cool thing too, Abe, is that the first dead animal that Kurt kind of, you know, that shows up in his house is the coyote or the wolf. And what is the coyote or the wolf, right? It's a hunter.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically foreshadows that he is the hunter, but he is the one who is actually going to get slaughtered in the end.
Now,
that image. I thought that worked for me.
Yeah.
Well, Coyote's also Native American, right, as a trickster.
Right, yes.
And that kind of plays in with Echo. Mm-hmm.
Now, there was one thing I was a little thrown off by. Because at first I thought the ghost had killed the coyote until the other hauntings later on. Because when he goes out to check the graveyard, it's partially dug up. And most of the girl's body had completely fallen apart. And I was like, how much time has fucking passed?
Well, I think that's part of the... Because we were a little, I think, off on some of the timing early, too. But it's it's clearly they show the season's going. I mean, they don't... To their credit, I guess, they don't do that old, you know, let's look at the calendar and let's look at everybody changing their decorations. And but you clearly go through the whole seasons, as Phil mentioned earlier. So you're talking about a year, right? I think is when all this transpires.
That's a good question, Mike. I have no idea.
Well, because we get to the point where there was a pumpkin, so we know we reached October, and there was even the hunting scene later towards the end where the two, where Kurt and the mother go out to hunt deer. And it's much more, you know, snow covered then. So I guess at least get as far as December, at least in my opinion.
Well, and hunting season around here is November.
Right.
So that has to be
right, unless they were illegally hunting. Unless they were illegally hunting.
You and the illegal hunting, man, you've got this
well,
you got this fucking bugaboo. It's unbelievable.
Well, I that was the first thing I was thinking. I'm going, they're hunting. It's a lot of snow, and hunting's usually November, early December. And I'm thinking, so I was trying.
Yeah, but it's not like a 2-week season.
Phil, I think it was a year. It was a year because they clearly show the change of seasons. And at first I was confused because they got this big heavy snowstorm and then it's melting and shit. But then they're in spring. Then they go to summer. Yeah, it's
mentioned right after the accident that it was going to rain and turn everything to slush when the mom was out looking for her.
Okay, then if they were going to go hunting before the accident, then it could have been illegal hunting. Because
I don't really think that's relevant to the movie, Phil.
That's a fair point, Eric. Well, it was something that was bothering me.
No, it actually, Phil, no, you actually do have a legitimate point. However, she talks about, the daughter does, and this is only because I read the subtitles. She says, are you going to get your tags for next year? Next year is going to be her 7th year. But we don't actually figure that out. So it's like January when she picks her up in the car. But honestly, the sound in this for the vocals, a lot of it was very, very quiet. And that was easy to miss. I only picked that up because I rewatched that scene and read the subtitles, so it's easily missed. But what she was actually talking about was not going hunting. What she was referring to was, we're going to go hunting next year. Do you have the tags yet? Because in upstate New York, I think the tags are annually renewed, if I'm not mistaken. And I think you have to renew them like at the beginning of every year. I don't remember. I mean, my dad used to hunt had a cabin. Yeah, we had a cabin in the Adirondack State Park. And I remember my dad used to have to like freak out after Christmas about getting his hunting license for the summer. And I'd be like, what the fuck? Like, you know, because it was like so far away. I was a kid. And I was like, oh, my God, it's winter. Why are you thinking about this? So I don't know. That's one of the things I made a note of that I wanted to check. And maybe it's changed. Maybe you can get a hunting license year round now. But it was kind of my
New York would never give up a revenue stream.
So well, do you think they – well,
movie.
Anyway. But my point is, Phil, that you're right. But I think that's what she was talking about. I think she was talking about for the following season. Because then later in the film, Ivy says she could never wait for hunting season, Halloween. What more could a goth girl want? So I think this girl was probably bugging her at the end of hunting season every year to go get another tag. I mean, I don't know. I could be totally ignorant of hunting. Anybody out there who knows can write in and send us an email and tell us. But yeah,
again, it's each state. But yeah, it would make sense that it would be at least yearly. Like Mike said, no state wants to pass up a fee, you know, for, you know, more money. So
those bastards.
And you got to get a different license for every different type of weapon. So if you use rifles, then there's the crossbow season, and then there's the small game, and then there's the turkeys, and you know.
But if
on
you use
on.
A corkscrew,
I don't think that's legal.
See, Eric, you can just go out and kill deer with a corkscrew. Let's go.
Well, just because they don't have a license for it doesn't mean it's illegal.
I got a corkscrew license right here. Let's go.
That's true.
Anyway, back to the movie. What the fuck were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the hunting license and whether this was January or the fall, but Chrissy made a good point, which is she was talking about.
Well, but it kind of does because it comes back at the end, Eric.
Well, he makes a jack-o'-lantern, and that's the only reason it matters.
Yeah, because he says, oh, sure, I'd love to go hunting. I don't have tags. Did you get tags? And there's that whole business about the tags, which is part
nobody
of
nobody should
the
have group. Tags because fuck the government.
That's a fair point. That is. The government does. Yes. But you know what, Chrissy? That's a fair point, though, because at the end of the movie is when they do go hunting. And again, if this is a year, as you and Mike have mentioned, meaning this is like a 12-month scenario, this film, then it would make sense that at the end, which is near the end of the year, like December, early December, the hunting scene would happen then if that's near the end of the movie. So I think you're
well,
right.
Well, and there's another interesting thing too, because the daughter is connected to nature. The mother clearly was or is a psychic and has turned her back on her gift and is now using it to bilk people to make money, right? There's a whole thing about the wheel of the year, you know, the turning of a year. If you look in certain tarot decks, the Wheel of Fortune card, which is card number 10, is the wheel of the year. You know, it's got the four seasons on it and all that. So I think that was also significant.
and discuss what you're mentioning. What did the seventh deer, meaning she needed to get seven, and then the seven circles, and what? Obviously, we know seven, at least in Christianity, is the sign of you know, the Father, the Son, Holy Ghost, you know, the three sevens, whatever. But in this here, was there anything important to that, or was that just brought up as a thing to make us later in the film go, oh, when he says seven, it's being possessed by the girl because she was talking about seven earlier, and it has nothing to do with the symbolism of the number seven.
I don't think in this particular film it does have anything to do with the number seven. I think it was completely made up. I think. I asked Nathan about it. He studied many world religions, and he was like, I've never heard of this shit. So so I was like, yeah, I think. However, I think they did an excellent job passing it off as something that's real. And that's another place this movie gets kudos, because they made up stuff in a lot of places that really sounded real, that you could really buy into. That only if you truly understood certain things would you know that it was made up. And it was very well done. In other words, it stayed true to its own rules, right? It made up rules and it stuck to them. And we have all on this podcast watched movies that did not stick to their own rules. And this one did. But I love that whole thing about, I mean, a lot of ways – what this is, when she talks about the seven circles, it's basically talking about the same thing we've seen in other films. The seven circles are locked in grief. They will warp everything within them. Every gift has its own twisted curse. I mean, these are all tropes that we have seen in horror films and before, but yet they combine them in a really unique way. And the language that they wrote, you know, when she sits there and reads about the seven circles was just beautiful. Yeah. You know, it was gorgeous. I mean, twixt the land of the living and the darkness of death, there hangs an invisible realm, a great sphere suspended by the bare string of the lost who lived, but linger unwilling to release their souls into the eternal mouth of death. And it goes on. It's just beautiful. I mean, it sounds like it was in an old book. I tried Googling some of that language. Nothing came up. I asked Nathan about it. He said, there is nothing like that that I've ever heard of. So I think they made it up. Kudos to them, because it was beautifully done and it was very believable and it looked real. And also after that, you know, I had mentioned earlier, the tarot card reading in this was really well done. As a tarot card reader for a number of years, I have seen way too many films use the tarot deck as a throwaway, as a way to communicate a message that's like, here's a hammer, let me bang you, audience, over the head with this. And this is one of the only films I've seen that actually used them the right way, and stayed true to like the basic meanings. Okay. If you're a tarot reader, you know that each card can have 10 to 20 meanings. And that depends on the person you're reading. It also depends on what the other cards are in the spread. When you lay down tarot cards, you do a spread. So let's say, Eric, let's say you came to me and said, I would like to know about my job. And I would say to you, okay. So I would tap into your energy, Eric, and then I'd say, what do you want to know specifically about your job? And you would say to me, well, I would like to know what's going on with this dickhead who's telling me what to do, and I'm kind of pissed off. Every tarot reader that you talk to has what we call a library of spreads. And what spreads are is each card is laid down in a certain position. So I would say to you, okay, Eric, here's your past with this dickhead. Here's your present with this dickhead. Here's your future influence with your dick, with this dickhead. And in this position we have, here's what you need to actually do to beat this dickhead. Does that make any sense? Like, each position has a meaning. So each card that you put in that position, the meaning changes. What I was impressed with in this film is that they took the most basic meanings and they used the most basic spreads to get the audience to understand on a deeper level without giving you a hammer to beat you over the head with it. However, it was very true to life. Like when she does that spread and she talks about, this is your foresight, this is your insight, this is your whatever, your past sight. I wrote that down.
Hindsight?
Hindsight, yes. And she wrote those down. Now, the cards that she laid down within the context of that spread made absolute fucking sense. They were right on. Whoever they got to consult, either the writers knew this themselves or they consulted someone, knew their fucking shit. Because cool. Most of the time when you do a movie like this, like the first card she laid down, for example, right? She does that reading for the old widow. Every time we see tarot in a movie, oh my God, we get the death card. Ooh, death. Ooh, no, it's the death card. Okay, first of all, the death card actually means, it rarely means actual death. In fact, that is one of the cards that almost never means real death. It never does. It is a transformation. It is the idea of an ideal is dying, or a relationship is dying, or you are resisting the death of something if it comes up reversed. So in this film, the first thing she does is lay down that death reversed card with Mrs. whatever her name was. And what that actually means in the context of what she was telling that woman. Now, of course, she was also bilking her. So I think that she actually had planted that death card in a certain way to bilk her out of money. Because remember, in the car, she says to the daughter, oh, I'm going to make her wait. Right. She's playing. She doesn't want to make her wait.
And that scene, Chrissy, was the one I was talking about where it looks like her head is floating. And
yes.
I thought that was so cool looking. And then later in the movie, they did it different, and she was like wearing a hood, and it didn't look like she was floating anymore. I was like, that was so cool. Why did you change it?
Well, because later in the movie when she does that, she is actually being exposed to her own lies that she's told other people. That's her karma coming back. So in other words, to this woman, right, that she's reading, the elderly lady, she appears as the see-all, the be-all, the know-all, but she's a trickster. But later on in the movie, and that's where the clown symbolism comes in, she's actually talking to herself, and she repeats that whole conversation, but the clown part of her is on the other side, meaning she's the fool. She is now the fool, which is also another card in the tarot deck, which she brings up before that scene happens.
And
so, yeah, my point is that tarot-wise, this film is very solid. It's if you know tarot cards and you watch this film, you're going to figure out what's going on pretty fast because you understand it. But whoever did this knew their shit, and I was extremely impressed. Cool. It wasn't just, here's a death card, dude. You know, in this particular case, when she lays down the death card in the beginning, she's actually trying to play the elderly woman, right? So she lays it down in reverse deliberately, because most people, if they don't know tarot cards, see the death card, they freak out. They think it means literal death. They don't understand all the different layers of that. So that's why movies a lot of times will use that card.
Chrissy, you know what's interesting about this film is that they use the Ten of Swords as the ominous card instead.
Correct. Yes, and the Ten of Swords is a very ominous card. However, she's right on in that reading when she says there is a sun beyond it, which is true, because the Ten of Swords not only stabs you to death and you're bleeding, it also represents the completion of something. And swords are associated with air, which is associated with the intellect. So very often, it's not an emotional completion. It is an intellectual completion.
But,
in other words,
Chrissy?
Yes.
I did, sorry to interject, but...
No, go ahead.
But the thing was interesting was that she tried to make a positive spin, but being the person she is at that moment, because obviously the loss of her daughter or missing daughter, she goes, or at least that's what they say, a new beginning. End always leads to a new beginning. And then after a second, she goes, well, at least that's what they just kind of said.
Right. But that's true, though, because that really did come true. There was a new beginning. And after he leaves, she lays down the Fool card, which is a new journey. That is the beginning of the new journey.
Now,
starting over, the Fool going forward, not knowing what's ahead and just plunging into it. So, I mean, yeah, but you're right, Phil. You're absolutely right. But what I'm saying is, Ten of Swords, yes, it's always a painful card, usually. But sometimes it's almost like the Tower card, where it's like that death that just needs to freaking happen. Like, you need to get stabbed 20,000 times to be like, oh, shit.
Right.
I need to move on. And, like, the big conversation that is going on with a lot of empaths and tarot readers and psychics right now, and I will say there are a lot of charlatans out there. You guys got to watch it. There's a lot of people who are very genuine. there are a lot of people who will take advantage of you, who are liars. And I know who they are. Like every time I go to a fair, I go get my tarot cards right if there's a tarot reader, just to see if she's bullshit or not. I can usually tell. Just
you got your $20.
Yeah, but I'll do it just to call her out on her bullshit and go, yeah, no, that's not what that means. I'll sit there and do that now, right away.
One thing that was very interesting about the full arcana and how it represented the film is the contrast between how she presented herself to her client and how she was presented in the clown clothing, how ragged and disheveled all the costume was.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, because she was the fool. She realized she was the fool because she turned off her sight. Mm-hmm. And her daughter, the first two things her daughter whispers to her that she hears is, I love you, Mom. The second thing she hears is, I see. And what is this all about? Her mother has turned off her sight. The thing I thought that was lacking in this film was we didn't find out why she turned off her sight.
Right. That's a good point.
I really missed that. I was like, where is that? I want just a hint. Like, they put a wedding ring on the guy to tell us that, oh, shit, something bad happened to him with his marriage. That we don't know what it is, but we know something's going on. But there's no clues about Ivy.
Now, yeah.
And I kind of wanted to know, why did she turn off her sight? What was the deal there? Why did she give it up? Why did she become a trickster to make money? You know?
Yeah, I part of me keeps thinking that perhaps that was a mistake by the actor, because he might have had his wedding ring on, because the lead actress was his wife.
That's what I was thinking too, Abe, that maybe it was he just made a mistake and he forgot to take it off for the movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think you need to explain all of these things. I mean, here's a guy who is alone. He is drinking heavily. He's making his living by fixing up something that old houses. He clearly is lonely. He has no one. And
maybe
I think
his wife died because he was driving drunk.
Or who knows what it was, but it's just the idea that
That's the story I just made up in my head. I'm sticking with it.
Right, and we can all look at... And by the way, that might have to do with part of the reason he... if you want to come up with a story like that, why he panics so much. Maybe he has a history of DUIs. You know, and things get worse. You can leave it, I think, to the viewer. I don't to enrich it. I like having those little details there, you know, without having to have every last bit of it filled in.
Now, I just want to back up two steps for a second, because Christy was talking about the tarot reading that she does for Kurt. And there's immediately after that, he gets all freaked out by it and asked to use the bathroom. And like this scene, I really like this scene because it was the first clue that we really get as to what exactly is going on. And I didn't quite get it while it was happening, but then later it clicked in. So I really thought that was pretty cool. He goes into the bathroom and he's standing up about to take a piss. And then all of a sudden he turns around, puts the toilet seat down and sits down and takes a piss and then rips off some toilet paper. And like, I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, what the fuck is this dude trans? What's going on here?
You didn't already know that he was possessed at that point?
No, I did not. So at that point, he's like very confused because he doesn't understand what happened. And so he like stands up and then like makes a point of raising the toilet seat before he leaves the room. And I thought that was really pretty cool.
Okay. I love that scene too. And Eric, I thought the reason he couldn't pee standing up was because he could not look at himself in the mirror. Because he kind of either, we know at that point that the girl is inside him. So either she cannot stand looking at the fact that she's possessing his body, which is my second choice. My first choice was, again, the guilt has built up at this point. And he
Can I ask you something? So you didn't think it was the girl had as much power or possession over him as he himself did? In other words, you didn't think it was the girl was taking over, and since a girl, they sit on the toilet when they go number one. So that's what I thought. You don't think that's what it was?
No, I don't. I think it was because he couldn't look at himself in the mirror. That was my first reaction.
I think it was totally that the girl was possessing him.
Yeah, I
do too.
Maybe. I mean, I think it's one of those things that could go either way. I don't think there's a right answer here.
Well, he couldn't look at himself in the mirror. That was certainly an aspect of it.
Yeah.
But that because was there. Maybe it was a triggering event. But I think at this point in the film, she's clearly, and because I was already on that page, that they were going to, that they were going through, and I kind of was a little ahead of the film because I saw this was a thing where there was, she was going to be possessing him and I think taking over his life. But I don't remember what exactly the line was or what was said earlier in the film that kind of clued me into that. And so, yeah, this was the first step, that this was a very female behavior that was occurring.
Well, and there was the one line that she, when it was at the house, and he went down into the basement and found, like, was it a partial deer carcass?
Yeah, the legs.
Yes. It was like the legs or something, yeah.
And ended up with, and maybe it was, I was really unclear as to whether it was just a hallucination or not. But he ends up thinking he has blood all over himself. And she appears and says, "Now I'm in your head." So that was kind of weird the way that happened.
Well, I think a lot of that is, even though she isn't truly malevolent to the point of like some revenge ghosts that we've seen in films like Body Cam and whatnot, she was playing with him as revenge, and that was kind of a way that she did it, I think. In other words, she did the illusion to freak him out, and then it disappeared, and then that's when she said, "See, now I'm in you," you know, like, haha, you know, like.
Well, but he was still fighting it at that point. It's not till he gets home, which is a scene or two later, that he's actually talking with her while he's looking in the mirror in the bathroom, and you kind of see that in shadow. And so to me, he was still fighting it. Remember, there's several points in this film where he says, I'm Kurt, you know, toward the end, after she's already in his body and he's fighting it. So to me, him leaving the toilet seat up, because he leaves the bathroom, or he starts to, then he comes back and throws the toilet seat up and went, oh, that's him still trying to be a guy.
Right.
So yeah, Kurt's still in there fighting. She's in there and she's definitely winning, but she hasn't totally won yet.
Chrissy, do you think he went back to fight the girl, or did he go back just because it was second nature? I think it was because he was fighting, right?
I think it was because he was fighting, because I totally saw that motion as a sign of male dominance.
Well, I didn't see it as male dominance. I saw it as soul dominance, where he was trying to take his
possession of his
body back.
Right, but I mean, because he's a guy, what's one way you show your dominance, right? I leave the toilet seat up. Like, I'm not trying to be, like, sexist here. I'm just saying that that's one way. Now, on the other hand, yes, exactly. That's exactly what I thought, Mike. It was like marking his territory. Now, on the other hand, I do know at least three men in my life who do occasionally sit down to pee, so for because of various reasons, health issues or whatever. So to me, that wasn't as weird as it might have been to your average healthy American male, you know?
Well, there's no doubt
I was kind of like, oh, I've seen this before. Okay. At first I was like, oh, is he having a problem with his prostate? Like, at first, that's what I thought. I was like, oh, okay. And then he was sitting down, I'm like, oh, he just had a problem. And then I was like, no, dumbass. Go back and look at that scene. That has nothing to do with this movie. So I had to rewind it and rewatch it again and then look at him looking in the mirror. And then I figured it out from there. But I have seen plenty of unwell men in my life do that because there are certain ways that they, because they have health issues or like I said, whatever. And so to me, it wasn't a standout right away, if that makes any sense. But that's just because I'm coming from a very different personal experience that has nothing to do with anything. So, yeah.
Now, Chrissy, did you think this guy had – well, he was lonely, but do you think he had behavioral health – let me rephrase that. Was he a behavioral health individual prior?
Yes, I think he was. I think he was a whack, but I think it was suppressed. You know, and I think this was a trigger for him. I mean, who the fuck goes up to the middle of Sullivan County? You know, and he even says this house makes noises. Like before the girl got there, the house was making noises. Before that shit went on. You know, it's the first scene. So obviously, I mean, who the hell does that unless you have problems?
Now I'm thinking, yeah, that even though the ghost was haunting him, or at least that's what he thinks, I think he was a little wackadoodle anyway. Because every time he spoke to the cops or to the mother, I at first thought it was because of the guilt, but he came off more as a kook than a guilt. And that's why I think the mother and the police never suspected him because of that. They just thought he was a kook because it comes off as him being having issues rather than him being guilty. When he spoke to them, I felt. I don't know. Anyone?
I think the mother was suspicious.
Oh, yeah. I think she was actually more onto him than the cops were. You know, there was certain, I think, even before some of Echo's personality and words started coming through him, she had a feeling there was something wrong. Because there was moments where he was driving by her, looking at her, wouldn't stop, like she was on the road looking for her daughter. We encountered him in the store, and he was acting strange. There's a lot of weird little points, but she didn't have any real proof, and this is before she's tried to reestablish her connection to her spirituality.
Yeah, okay. All right, so what are the scenes that we haven't talked about that we want to bring up? I don't know, actually. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that was hard to explain, like a lot of those dreamy sequences and stuff.
Yeah, there was some of that stuff I just really didn't get. I was kind of like, whatever. I didn't really think it added anything to the film.
I mean, if you cut those out, they wouldn't really be missed because they don't really alter anything.
Let me ask you this. Yeah, that's fair. Well, let me ask you this. Anybody, actually. Was there any importance to the fact that the dollars that they kept on using was the $50 bill? Because it's uncommon. I mean, I usually get them when I go to the bank every so often, I get them or whatnot. But every transaction she does, whether it's in the dreams or those weird scenes or with the elderly woman, it's always $50. And not $50 like two 20s and a 10, but a $50 bill. I was just curious if that meant anything to anybody that was watching the film, because I...
Well, 50 is always like half of something, right? And so she's a charlatan in the beginning, and she shut down her site, so she's really only giving 50% of herself. You know, she's kind of half bullshitting. But the second thing is, in tarot, a 5 is usually a struggle card. There's 4 suits in tarot. Plus the major arcana, but we're just going to look at the 4 suits. The 5 of cups is intense emotional loss, grief, You know, you are grieving the three cups you lost without seeing the two that are still in front of you. Or it might be the other way around. I kind of forget because I look at them so often. The Five of Wands is a struggle with competition, right? You're competing against someone. The Five of Swords is an all-out, I'm going to slash your head off type of a real battle. And the Five of Pentacles is poverty. So the five represents, in tarot decks, represents a struggle on all of these different levels. And that's what this woman's going through. And it also represents she's calling it in half-assed. Like I said, when she lays down that death reversed card, what that really means in that opening scene with that lady is that she, Ivy, it's a reflection on her, the reader, is refusing to change. She is refusing her calling. She is resisting her transformation. And it is at that moment that she hears her daughter say, "Mom, I love you." And that is the thing. That is her crisis, Phil, like you said, or her conflict. Her conflict is her daughter says, "Mom, I love you." And she actually hears it. And so she is now going to come back in touch with her sight. So I think that's what that 50 represented. I think certainly someone else might have a different interpretation, but that's what I kind of got out of it. That's what hit me in the face.
Let me ask you this too, Chrissy. Echo, Ivy, the mother-daughter names, and then Kurt is the stranger's name. Anything to do with that? Do you think Echo is just maybe a nickname or and, you know, Ivy, it's a common enough girl's name, but not that common. So do you think any of the names
Echo,
had anything?
I mean, yeah, I would definitely say so. I mean, Echo, obviously, we can kind of literally translate that because she dies, right?
Right.
She dies. So she is like a shadow.
An echo in the pretty much in the past and the future.
Right. And that even comes back, you know, again, later, right, when they're in the woods, right? And he says, "Oh, do you hear that? There's an echo." You know, when it's really himself kind of being taken over, but still, that's what it means. Ivy, I believe, it has a number of different meanings, but I think, I know it has something to do with faithfulness.
Well, I'd also say ivy is obviously is a plant, right? It's a clinging vine,
yeah.
Right? And so she's
clinging
on to her daughter, and it's kind of sort of parasitic, right? And
that's right,
right.
So, and she is someone who is bilking her clients. You know, she is a parasite on her own. She, if you buy into the karma, it's, you know, there is some karma to the suffering that she's going through, right? Because she's being dishonest with her customers. You know, she's a scam artist.
Yeah. Yep. Totally. And Kurt, actually, in the Turkish meaning, and I just looked this up just now. I did not know this off the top of my head. The Germanic meaning means polite and courteous. But I think it's interesting that in, what does it say, Turkish origin, it means wolf. Hmm. And, of course, that's the first thing that's killed on the floor is the wolf or the coyote, whatever. They're all related. But you know what I mean? It's the symbolism of it. It the foreshadowing that I mentioned earlier, that he's going to be the first one that's going to be killed. And he is, obviously, in the end. He dies as a soul.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let me ask you this, too. And A brought it up earlier. The corpses of the various animals that appear, whether or not they're in his imagination or they're real or not, most of them, I noticed, were predators, such as the coyote and a fox and things of that nature.
Well, yeah. And she keeps rather saying, "You need to tell my mother what you did." Like, she knows he's a predator, basically. Although I really didn't get the sense of that. I almost felt like he was an accidental predator. Like he was doing it just because it was there. Like, I don't know. It, like,
oh, yeah,
he
right.
Yeah.
He wasn't, this is the type of murder of an idiot rather than a malevolent person. In other words, he was not out there intentionally going out to murder people or to run people over or to cover up crimes. This is, so he's not a predator like someone that goes out to rob and rape or mug or whatever. So I would agree with you that. So unless she decided, meaning the ghost, the echo, decided to use predators as a guilt trip, because when someone is called a predator or to be implied a predator, they then themselves are considered tainted in a sense, rather than, you know, a deer or something that's more innocent. And again, he's not innocent because he did do the crime, even if he isn't a true predator. I don't know. It's just curious.
Well, and also it's interesting too, because one of the shots I really liked, Eric or Mike, maybe you can comment on this, because I know I think one of you said you loved how this was shot.
Yeah,
one of the shots, Eric, one of the shots I loved the most was after he kills the girl and puts her in her truck, right, with her sled. We see him driving from his perspective through the windshield, and all we hear is his breathing.
Right.
With the snow in the headlights. And I love that, because that was almost a foreshadowing that he was about to be no longer driving the car of his own body. I really like that.
Just to get back to the name for a second, but Kurt, of course, I mean, does have an English meaning, right? It's spelled differently, but, you know, to be kind of rude, to be short.
That's
true, too. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, you're
also,
right.
Also, the C, Kurt, versus the K, Kurt. C is the Anglo spelling, and the K is the Germanic spelling. And I don't know if that meant anything, but I think maybe it's like you said, Mike, assuming that Kurt was used that way, to not make it so blatantly, they decided to go with the K spelling, but I don't know. That's a good question. What about the reveal, the best reveal of the film, in my opinion, was the sled in the rafters at the end.
I am so with you on that.
Wasn't that awesome? That's when she was like, that proved everything.
Yeah. I was a little confused as to whether that actually happened or not. Because at that point, it was kind of flipping back and forth between, like, what was going on and I don't know, premonitions or whatever the hell was going on there. It was very flipped back and forthy. So I was a little confused as to whether that revere actually happened or whether it was a vision of some sort.
You know what, Eric? I could see why you would think that, because it's kind of sloppy. I mean, it's in theory a decent hiding place or a decent place to put something like that when you're, you know, just to get out of the way. But if you're going to cover up a crime to the point where you bury the body, cut up the body and do all these other things.
Right. You think you get rid of the sled, right?
Exactly.
A lot easier than getting rid of a dead body.
But again, you'd be amazed how stupid criminals can be.
Yeah.
Especially criminals that weren't intending to be criminals.
Right.
I love the little scene where she's actually criticized, and it's like, as far as you can dig, lazy ass.
Repeat that once. Hey, but I didn't get that.
Well, when she appears before Kurt after he digs up the second time to try bury it slightly deeper, and she's like, that's as far as you can dig, lazy ass.
Oh, well, you know what's funny too, Abe, is that as you guys all mentioned that it's like a 12-month thing, as every at the very beginning when he's burying her, I mean, it's cold ground. I mean, it's almost impossible to bury, right? And then when he tries to rebury her at points, like you said, the ghost says, oh, you know, whatever. But then when it's thawed, he's able to bury it, I guess, better, but again, he never really buries the body that
no way. He ends up jumping it in the well or something.
He
cuts her up and dumps her in the well, which, by the way, isn't really a bad place to hide a body if you know it's going to be there for a while, because it's going to decompose.
And if you're not using the well.
Oh, gross. Oh my god. But it was interesting, because when she said, and this ties into the title of the film, Is that the deepest you can go, lazy ass? That was almost a metaphor for his own problems. You know, like he clearly had, you know, he was a behavioral health individual.
Yes.
And he clearly had issues. And it was almost like she was saying to him, what are you, fucking stupid? Like, you don't see your own issues. Like, I just kind of liked that line. It was a little telegraphy to me, but I thought it was cool. There was a lot of shit in this movie to like. There was a lot of stuff that was weird, but I liked
it. You know what else is interesting about the character of Kurt is that he definitely does not have interpersonal skills. And I think this included even before the manslaughter. Or actually, it was first degree at one point after the second time. But the thing is when he's in, we first see him, he's in the convenience store, and the guy, the counter clerk, is talking to him, and he doesn't say a word the entire scene. And I felt it was kind of weird. Right. And then when he's with the mother and he's getting the tarot, he says, I got to go piss. Where's your bathroom? Instead of saying, oh, I have to use the restroom, could you show me the way or something? You know,
well,
I mean,
because he's Kurt.
Did anybody else love that moment where he throws the tarps on the counter of the convenience store and then walks away to get something? And in the meantime, Ivy comes in and puts down the flyers and says, give these to everybody. And then when he comes back, there's the flyer with the girl he killed.
Yes.
I loved that. I was like, that is so genius.
Was that all coincidental? I thought he like ducked out of the site because he saw her.
I don't know. I thought it was coincidental because he had to go back.
No, I thought it was coincidental, too.
All right.
Right.
I saw her coming.
I thought but
ducked around the corner.
Right. Well, another reason why, another good wink to us to know that he's been possessed, and it's a callback from earlier in the film, and the way they wrote it to make us remember it was really good without making it too obviously of a Chekhov's gun, was when the daughter, Echo, is going to get a cinnamon something spice coffee.
And the mother
says, you're not getting that because then you're going to be all up all night.
Oh, yeah.
And
that
then
totally
later,
got by me.
Yeah, and then later in the film, he decides to get that drink. And that's when the girl has already kind of possessed him. And even the clerk is looking at him like he's nuts because he usually comes back with a six-pack of beer or something.
Beer and stuff. Yeah. I thought that, like, it was kind of an interesting sort of body horror, but in more of a ghost story-wise. You know, it wasn't like for any like huge major changes. Like, he wasn't taking like any new shape. But it was really interesting to how sometimes he wasn't even aware what he was changing. You know, there were these moments would suddenly pop up in the worst moments.
Well, that's the thing, Abe. Does he not? Is he not aware?
Well, yeah.
Is he not aware, Abe? Let me ask you this question, and you can answer it. Is he not aware, or is she already possessing him mostly at that point, and so it just goes over the head of his being?
No, because there was a moment where when he goes hunting with the mother, and he bags the deer.
Yeah, the seven.
And he's completely shocked that he said that. The mother understood what it meant, but he didn't understand why he said it. So he was aware that he said something he didn't even want to say. So he's doing these things at moments where he's completely under the girl's control, but other moments where he does something and he realizes, why did I do that?
Right. It's sort of like if Eric murdered Phil and then Phil possessed him and he's not aware of it, but then suddenly he finds himself referring to someone as a behavioral health individual.
Or listen to
him. Like, why am I doing that when they're just really wackadoodle?
Or just listen to endless volumes of Taylor Swift music.
Right. Start not pronouncing your R's.
Oh, that would be horrible.
And then what's the other one I was going to use?
A fate worse than death.
And calling everybody a sociopath.
Yep. Take a drink.
And talking about the
Mike's a sociopath.
But in all honesty, to go back to the film itself, I think you may be right, Abe, that he knows something's up. And again, I think, Chrissy, you're right, too, because he then fights it because, for example, he runs back into the bathroom to raise the lid on the toilet. So he knows he can't stop it from happening because she takes over, but then he tries to fight it. And, of course, a few times it doesn't matter because once he says, oh, I bagged the seventh in front of the mother, that's a red flag for the mother right there. Do you think the mother and Kurt, do you think the mother actually kind of liked Kurt and wanted to date him before?
I don't know about date him, but yeah. I think she liked him.
She definitely liked him, yeah. They were kind of two lonely souls.
Did she like him? Shut up, Mike.
Well, I know Mike's being funny, but I think if she didn't find out he was a murderer of her daughter. I think she did may have liked him, Mike.
Yes,
so,
I agree. I think maybe it's me, but I got some, and for that matter, you, but I definitely got the sense that there was some sort of weird interest there. And I think she was probably a little confused because on the one hand, she's not sure. She's suspicious of the guy, but she doesn't really have a reason to be suspicious of the guy.
Right.
Exactly. And of course, hey, maybe the reason she's kind of attracted to him in the wrong way, don't take this the wrong way, but is the fact that the daughter's inside of him, and so she likes him for that reason.
Yeah, maybe. And also, they're both lonely individuals, too, right? So,
right.
So they had, they're lonely souls and whatever, and yeah. And then, of course, she finds the worst. But then Eric has a good point, too, which is, did she just figured out because of the ghost, or were the hints really there, like the sled, or the him saying seven and things like that too? So I mean, maybe it's a combination of both. And then of course, once she knows that he did it, it's all over.
I gotta say, I freaked the hell out during that vision when he decapitated himself with his sawzall or
right.
Whatever the hell it was. I was like, wow, that's intense.
That, you know what? That would have been awesome if it wasn't a vision. Right. And that's the thing. That's another thing I think everybody, that all five of us kind of agree with, is that all these weird visions and endings at the end were maybe too many, and they should have just stuck with one, maybe. And maybe, in other words, it was a great scene because it was cool, but I think they may have just added that in because it was a great scene and it's cool.
Yeah,
rather than
here's an example, because the fact is, this was during the final confrontation. She thinks she's tackling Kirk and she actually starts beating the absolute shit out of him, and suddenly he vanishes, turns around, and there's this confrontation scene. But before she stops punching, she sees her daughter, and then there's a cohabitation scene. And I'm thinking, like, what the fuck's going on here? Why is this happening? Because is the ghost screwing with her now for some reason?
Right. That's right.
Like, why would the daughter be sabotaging her mother's chance to stop getting her killed?
Maybe part of the reason is the whole time she was a behavioral health individual as well. And so we're looking through a woman that's looking for her daughter and is willing to go have vengeance, but is also a behavioral health individual the entire time of the film.
No,
I don't know
what happened.
So
then I don't know why they had all those. Yeah, go on, Mike.
Well, I think part of the thing is, and it's something I think we discussed way back when we did Drag Me to Hell, is that there's a difference between justice and revenge. And sure. I think the daughter wanted revenge.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
You know, I don't think she was interested in getting this guy in prison. She was taking his life because he took hers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, but no, I agree with you on all that, Mike. It's just that it's like, why do they show the scene where he decapitates himself or these various endings that happen? But then we find out that our lead actress, the mother, is imagining these things herself or is in the same dream as Kurt.
And well, Abe made a good point because she's psychic.
Right, but Abe made a good point, which is why is the ghost playing with her mind unless she's a behavioral health individual herself?
I don't know if she's behaving. I'm not sure if she's playing with her mind or if she's just picking up on the signals from Kurt.
Yeah, because it does. I mean, clearly it's like the guy said, her friend that she went to in that one scene, he kept saying, you turned your back on your gift.
And you'll pay.
And you'll pay for that. And that was also kind of what bugged me a little bit, too, because honestly, I didn't really see her pay, which is also kind of leads me back to the Poe-esque thing at the end. Kind of made me wonder if that was really her daughter or inside his body or if she was hallucinating. Like, I totally wasn't sure.
Yeah, same here.
I took the ending to be literal, which is why I didn't like it. Because to me, like, I can kind of buy the concept of a spirit temporarily possessing somebody as a form of haunting, right? I have a lot more trouble buying the concept of somebody, a spirit permanently inhabiting somebody's body. That doesn't work for me, which is why I didn't like the ending.
I can't help but picture now Kirk walking around with the blue lipstick and everything like that, going to school and everything.
Yeah, there is a creepiness factor to it, and that I think is a little bit unsettling.
Well, and she also Kurt also has the girl's voice too, which obviously wouldn't happen because of the vocal cords. But again, that's why I'm thinking the mother is kind of whack. Behavioral health individual as well.
Because if we had to look at it another way, maybe the screwdriver, the guy lobotomized Kurt some way.
And yeah, that's what I thought too. Yeah.
Also, I ended up inadvertently laughing because they used such a bad cartoon sound effect when the damn screwdriver goes in the eye. It sounded like a ketchup bottle exploding.
I didn't know. It's
a budget movie.
Now, yeah, Mike, I know, but you could have used something better. You could have used a sound effect, something stabbing a tomato or something. It could have sounded a little more realistic.
But Mike,
because you know what it sounds like when you stab somebody in the eye with a screwdriver.
Yes, he does.
We just learned something about Abe.
You're next, Eric. You're next.
Mike, did you notice? And Eric mentioned that he didn't like the soundtrack and whatnot. But did you notice that soundtrack sounded like the aliens from War of the Worlds?
You mean the tripods?
Yeah, exactly.
Which is weird, kinda, yeah. Because usually I pick that up. I know that sound very, very well.
Yeah, because I immediately texted Mike that. I go, holy smokes, they're using the sound effects from War of the Worlds.
Well,
the tripods, Abe. I'm talking about the 1956 film, the ones where the floating ships.
Oh, the
technically they were tripods.
Yeah, that one. Yeah,
it's kind of almost like the classic UFO floating sound, but it's a little more.
Yeah. That.
Yeah. Okay, I was like, because I thought it was the most recent one, because that was like that's pretty distinct.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, the end. Obviously, that's the thing is that this film ends where. It does, but obviously if you continue, she's going to probably have to answer a lot of questions as well, because she's going to have this Kurt guy with no eye in her house, basically lobotomized, as you said, Abe. So that's another thing is that I'm thinking maybe there is no ghost at that point. She's just crazy and thinks the guy's her daughter. And the guy is actually just lobotomized, meaning he's you know, a 3-year-old now because of the brain damage, and she's pretending he's the daughter.
No, I think he's the daughter.
Okay.
The lobotomized thing doesn't
make sense because he says something specifically that the daughter would know, like the extra marshmallow thing.
Yeah, that's true. He says it twice, too.
But I mean, why would look, I guess it's probably better than being dead or maybe not, depending on your belief system. But why would 15-year-old girl want to be in the body of a 40-something-year-old one-eyed man? So that's the creepy part.
Well, yeah, and also there's that's the other reason the ending didn't work well for me, is because I was looking at this whole thing as a vengeance movie. And I guess if she steals his body, that's kind of vengeance. But I don't know.
Where's the end game at that point? He's now, what should you do now?
Like, when he decapitated himself, I was really happy. Like, I would have been cool if that was the end.
That would have been awesome. I'm agreeing with you right there, Eric. Absolutely. And I wish that's where they went with it, to be honest. That would have been better. Kind of.
Oh, cool. Well.
Yeah. Chrissy, now, whose film was this? Echo was not really a main factor in the sense of screen time. So was it Kurt's film or was it really the mother's film? Because the second...
I actually think it was both.
Okay.
I think it's one of those rare movies because they both had arcs.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, if you think about it. And they were split in terms of balance of screen time. And I think... Well, to me at the beginning, there were several, like I said, foreshadowing things that I mentioned that kind of indicated to me that it was going to be, they were both going on a journey. You know, the mother's story and Kurt's story, even though they were separate in the beginning, they were happening in concurrent time. And I could see these things colliding and going, yeah, I think this might be a story that's going to be interesting. Pardon me, which is why I kind of kept wanting to go forward with it, because it was not just one person's story. It really felt like, to me, like it was both of theirs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the, you know, and there was other foreshadowing too, in that Echo is, even though she becomes a ghost and she dies, she kind of goes through a rebirth too. I mean, you guys were just talking about how, why would she want to be in the body of this old man? You know, she was kind of resistant to her mother a little bit, even though they got along, which is one of the things I thought the movie also did well, because it wasn't like, I'm the belligerent teenager and I'm going to do what you tell me not to and blah, 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 and then I die. They got along. You know, she did kind of go against her mother's wishes, I think, a little bit, but she wasn't terrible. But I mean, I find it interesting that he throws her in the bathtub and she's in a fetal position, and then he kills her when she's in the fetal position.
Well, and I
so
think,
she's
oh,
about
I have...
to be born as a ghost, basically.
The bathtub was the womb.
I have such a problem with that decision, though. Like if you hit somebody with your car, you thought you killed them, and then you find out that they're not dead, is your next instant thought going to be, oh, they're not dead, gotta kill them now?
Well, in fairness, in real life, he was her father, so he figured this is his chance.
That is true. That is true. Yes.
No, but seriously, like, I don't know. If it were me in that position, I would have called somebody from the side of the road. But even let's say I throw her in the back of my truck and she wakes up later, like at that point, I get her back in the fucking truck and take her to the hospital. And she says, oh, you had me in the bath. I was like, oh, I don't know what she's talking about. She must be confused. She hit her head.
Right. Yeah. Now that he sobered up a little bit and she's not dead, I would have just lied to her and said, I got to take you to the hospital now, blah, 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 whatever. And then at that point, he could just say it was a mistake, and he probably would have got off because the mother would say, yeah, I told her not to do so, that. I mean, and
it has to happen for the rest of the movie, but just, like, logically, I had an issue with that particular decision.
Well, and here's the other thing, too. It's snowing. It's icy. They make a very big point of saying how terrible it is, and we all know that if you get in a car accident in the snow, all you have to do is go, dude, man, the road was icy. Like, nobody's going to question your ass.
Right, right. Oh, actually,
well, but this will go to
it's true. No, but it's true. There's, like, first of all, this is a years ago, this guy that I used to be friends with, he actually was speeding on an off ramp and flipped this truck over during the winter, and a lot of it was because he was drunk, or partly drunk. The cops come, they didn't bother testing him because they just thought he was nervous and you know, because he was shaking and all that, because he thought he was going to die. So he got off completely. So you're right, Chrissy. They could have just said, oh yeah, yeah, and not even thought that he was drunk, because again, bad weather, out of control, girl on sled, middle of the night, you know, all this other stuff. So there's a chance that he could have got off without even being detected as having been under the influence. At least that's what I think. And then in the bathtub, at that point...
Well, no, I do agree with that. And yes, the bathtub is a symbol of the womb. But Phil, here's the other interesting thing. And this did... And again, this is a total fucking nitpick because I didn't care that much. But here you're talking about a teeny little town in Sullivan County in the middle of nowhere. Some guy clearly buys the most haunted, abandoned fucking house that all the kids go party at because, ooh, it's scary. And the cops don't even know who he is. You're right. Talking about a town with, like, I don't know how many people, like 2,000 or something. Like, those cops are going to know, like, oh, my God, that's the dude who bought the abandoned house. They're not going to not know his name. Like, especially when she says, oh, we used to come up here and party. Dude, the cops used to go there all the time. They would totally know who bought that house. You know what I mean? You're talking about a teeny place. You're not talking about Danbury or, like, where any of us live. Yeah, we all of us live in kind of relatively, I would say maybe, I don't know, Eric probably lives in a larger area than I do. And I know Mike lives near New York and there's a large population there. Abe and Phil, you live in small towns, but I think Mike will agree with me. You have not seen the meaning of small town until you go to upstate New. Like,
oh no! That's not true.
Like, oh my Lord! Like 20 people, they would know who he is. Holy shit!
Yeah, no, I live in.
It depends on the town that you're in.
Yeah, it depends on the town, and we do have a bunch of towns over here that are wicked small as well, and some of them don't even have cops. Like a town next door over doesn't even have cops. They use a three town police force type thing because they're so small. So, and there's like three cops for three towns basically. So it's kind of interesting how that works.
Yeah, in my area, I have, I think, four different police forces that can give me a ticket. It's awesome. I got the Michigan State Police. I got the Washtenaw County Police. I got the Pittsfield Township Police and the Ann Arbor City Police.
Oh, geez. Yeah, yeah. So, like, my town has, like, three, four police people, I guess. And then the next town over has two. And then the town after that is the one that has no cops.
Of the cops in my hometown I went to high school and got drunk with when I was 16. So,
yeah, well, this town here is definitely...
drunk in my hometown, I'm off. I got no problem.
And in this town here that this movie takes place, the cops... are the cops of that town, it appears. At least that's what I got out of it. Well, I have to say this, Chrissy. The Sasha Graham, known as the Tarot Goddess in that area of New York, was generously sharing her knowledge and love of the tarot with the filmmakers. So they went to a quote-unquote expert. So you were right. You were absolutely
sense.
Right. Yeah, and they thanked her in the credits.
Well, and I also appreciated that, like I said, the tarot cards were presented in the simplest way that made the most sense for the film. so that it wasn't like, hi, we're going to give you the obvious death card. You know what I mean? Like, so that you people will understand it. The cards were very accurate and right on. I mean, these people did a great job.
All right. So before we get into our final thoughts, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can get it wherever you found this one.
Eric, and you're almost at the 450th episode?
Oh, not for a while yet.
No, okay.
No, we had unlike this show, it's really hard to have something in the can for that one because we usually cover current events. So when we have to take off, it's just a week off and we get behind. So I think we just had, I want to say 414 was the last episode that went out.
Mike, me, you, and Eric do another podcast, like a spinoff or something?
Yes, we do. That would be the Cinema a la Carte, which we do once a month. And we take turns, each picking a movie that we would otherwise not do on Dark Discussions. We have done Hostiles. We have done Baby Driver. We have done Darling, was it?
Stalit.
We did Inside Out. And we recently did Forbidden Planet, and then we'll be doing another movie very soon, which is going to be one of Phil's picks. That is not, I don't think, something involving a little dog.
No, it's not.
But Stalit will be coming out within the next 2 to 3 weeks. The other two that Mike mentioned, Inside Out and Forbidden Planet, are coming after that. They're in the queue to be released. And then we're recording another one after that. So, yeah, absolutely. Abe, me, you, and Barrett, and unfortunately, Chrissy said she won't be able to join us, but me, you, and Barrett, and Kevin Letts are going to be doing an episode on a book or something.
So, every once in a while, when we get the chance to finally do a recording, we cover books that we have read. The first two episodes have been on some works of Stephen King. And now we've been on a spree of Lovecraft stories. The past episodes that we had done are currently up, but coming up soon, we've got a double feature of Lovecraft stories. I won't tell you what those are going to be. Just wait and see, because it should be an interesting conversation. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about those soon.
Yep. We got to set up the date, and everybody still has to finish reading up on the stories. Chrissy, you actually got some interesting or exciting stuff?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I have a lot of exciting stuff. My new issue of 34 Orchard, the fall issue, it's our second issue, is coming out in November, early November. And right now we are accepting submissions. You can go to 34orchard.com to check that out. And I have had several short stories published lately, which I hope to actually publicize on my blog this weekend and get them out there. I've just been so busy actually writing new things. You can find out what I'm up to at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
All right, very good. And what was the website for the Orchard?
34 Orchard. It's 34, like a number, Orchard, like an address. 34orchard.com.
Excellent, thank you. I had Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews podcast episodes are popping up every 2 to 3 weeks, so check those out as well. Now let's get our final thoughts on this film, so let's start with you, Abe.
Despite some of the pretentious of kind of overindulgent little artsy bits and some story beats that kind of left more questions and some things felt a little unnecessary, I overall enjoyed this film. I thought it was really cool that this family had put together a film. I mean, that was something very kind of special, and you can tell they put a lot of work into it. I thought the performance was strong from them, as well as all the rest of the cast to help support the story. There were some really cool shots, and some really interesting little moments that I think really add to the atmosphere and the kind of haunting, oppressive atmosphere they were going for. It's not exactly a scary film, but depending on the viewer, I think it will hold your attention or might bore you. I think it's going to be a hit and miss, but it's still, I think, in my opinion, worth a watch. I think it can really show you just, you know, what some people can do when they put their mind to something, for better or worse. But it's up and available on streaming. I think it's worth, you know, give it a shot. I mean, you might actually enjoy it. I thought it was overall a good watch. It might not be in my top 20 or my films of this year, but overall, I still enjoyed the watch, and it was a good discussion.
Okay, sounds good. Mike?
Yeah, I like the film. It does have a weakness. It does have those moments that I don't particularly care for, those dreamlike moments. The difference, Phil, since you brought it up at the start of the podcast, between that and what was the name of the movie again?
The Living and the Dead.
The Living and the Dead. Living and Dead was like a single 20-minute segment that just went on forever, where here it's a few short segments scattered throughout the film. So it was easier to just grit my teeth for a few minutes and let it go. I did kind of like it. I thought it was, I thought performances were good. The fact that it is a family-making movie really should have nothing to do with it, but I kind of added something to it. I don't know why. Knowing the backstory, I made me appreciate it a little bit more. So I like the film a lot. I would recommend it to anyone who's interested in this kind of thing. I would say I am not a ghost person or a tarot person in terms of real life. You know, I am very much a skeptic. So, but I imagine if you are, this might have a little bit extra appeal to you.
All right. Very good. For me, the film really wasn't for me. I mean, I probably won't revisit it, but it was very well made. Some of the scenes that were added were probably not necessary, especially the very psychedelic, strange ones. But all in all, it was a well-made film and very impressive for these group of filmmakers. Wouldn't mind seeing what they could do otherwise. I know their next film isn't supposed to be horror. I read a little article about that, so it may not be a Dark Discussions type podcast episode. But all in all, I don't know if I would recommend it to anybody, because again, I don't know who the audience really would be for the film. Maybe art house type of film folks, but I mean, I love art house type of film folks, and this still kind of didn't work for me, so I don't know. But maybe it's worth a shot and to take a chance, and maybe you'll like it, maybe you won't. Chrissy?
I liked this film a lot, but it may have something to do with the fact that I enjoy tarot. I love ghost stories. I love films that are heavy on atmosphere, and I always go for that poetic, is this guilt or is this the supernatural thing? So I would recommend this to people who really like a ghost story and have watched a lot of them and are just maybe looking for something to, I don't know, challenge you a little bit. Like I said, I think I mentioned the weaknesses I thought this film had, but overall they didn't bother me. But definitely it's not for everybody. So, you know, I mean, I personally would recommend it, but that's me. I would only do it if you were into ghost stories or, you know, you're just looking for something slightly different. Oh, and I did forget to mention, Phil, during this whole thing, I love some of those special effects, like when he shot her and she turned into black smoke. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, the special effects were pretty standout.
The special effects were pretty standout for this. Yeah, they really were. They were well done, and I forgot to mention that.
Yeah,
so, for an indie film, I thought this had really good special effects. So, and even the death at the end with all the gore was not that cheesy either. You know, you kind of get that like late 80s, like Gordon, whatever his name is, look. And this didn't have that. I thank you. What was it, Mike?
Herschel Gordon Lewis?
No, the other dude.
Stuart Gordon.
Yeah, they didn't have that cheesy look. I mean, they looked pretty good, I thought. So anyway, my thing is a recommend, but, you know, go with which host's opinion you normally follow and go from there. So.
Oh, Chrissy, one thing I did like was with the makeup was the vitreous humor sticking to the screwdriver when it came out of the eye.
Oh, my God, that was awesome. Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah. And I loved the way that he sees the ghost with her left eye missing, and then at the end, he's got the left eye missing.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, she stands at him in the shed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the movie.
Near the beginning. Yeah, near the beginning.
Near the beginning. And I think that's where she says to him, you lazy ass or something.
Yeah, that's exactly where she
says right.
Yeah. Yep, and he's got the eye is totally gone. And at the end, his eye looks exactly the same way when she's killing him in the snow. I just thought that was really well done. So anyway, sorry. That was another thing I forgot to mention.
Eric.
Oh, my turn?
Yes, it is, sir.
Oh, yeah, I like this movie. It's not going to be for everybody, but if you think you are game for a slow burn, semi-pretentious ghost story, then go for it. I don't know if this is going to be in my end of the year list, but I enjoyed it enough.
All right, very good. So this is did the festivals. So it does say 2019, but it was released everywhere. In April, I think it was, or May or something like that. But it's a 2020 film where it was released everywhere. Once again, the film's called The Deeper You Dig, and it is available wherever rentals are. It is not free at this time. You can also purchase it. Usually, I think it's about $3 to $5 more than the rental fee. So if you are interested in ghost stories, this may be for you. And with all that stated, Eric. Why don't you leave this out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Let's talk about The Deeper You Dig. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.